snow. Before I start, maybe I could deliver the approach. The idea probably was that I would call it super cinematic case here and so on. Since I was a little bit more excited about the results on G2, and this is only beyond the standard model, it's even exceptional. I thought I would rather talk about the G2 gauge theories, and I think I have some interesting results. Unfortunately, I didn't get all the results which were from last week going to the chemical potential up to 500 MeV. So my data stopped at 300 MeV, but you will see. These days it should come in, but unfortunately I don't have it today. Okay, so certainly if I working on G2 case to me, my collaborators, I should a little bit motivate why we are studying G2 case to me. And on the way, I will mention some facts about G2 case to me, since I don't assume that everybody is very long kind of exception. Then I will first, sort of as a warm up, tell you some results which are not completely new. They are 2 years old about pure G2 gauge theory, and then last year, 2 years ago, breaking from G2 to pure SU2. And the most important results are the results on spectroscopy, which is last year. And since a year or 1.5 years, we have the studies of research on the planet density and planet temperature also coming. Now, this work was done in collaboration with Arthur Maas, which is my position in class, Lorenz von Speker. They joined in later when we started doing dynamical fermions in the system. And the other studies were done with Christian Mutzer and Gregorhofen, and this group is very strong young fermions. They did more cooling, of course, they did start cooling from scratch by simulating G2 gauge theory.
It's for the world,
for the recording.
The universe.
Еще питание по окей,
Валентин. Fix it. Then I should speak more slowly and more clearly, right? So this is Christian and Björn, who did most of the coding. Okay. Now, before I start with my motivation, and I will tell you some facts about G2. And from these facts, you may already anticipate some of our motivations. So the rank of G2 is the same as the rank of SU3 is equal to 2. The dimension is a bit higher. It's not 8, but it's 14. So there are 14 gauge bosons in this theory. What is very important later on, when we study the breaking of G2, is that SU3 is a subgroup of G2, in a certain sense, a maximal subgroup. What is again very important for the coding, for the algorithms, to speed up the hybrid Monte Carlo algorithm, is that G2 over SO3, this coset space is a sphere. And this actually, we used this decomposition, so to say. So roughly speaking, G2 is S7 times SO3, roughly speaking. We used this fact very much in building up a very fast, I think, a very efficient algorithm. Now, one way to view the G2 group, this 14-dimensional group, is it's a subgroup of SO7. There are many ways to, at least three ways to characterize this subgroup. So probably the, in the abstract sense, the nicest one is you take the, the spinner representation of SO7 and take a constant spinner and take the little group of this, and this is just G2. Mathematicians like it because the automorphism group of the octonions are G2, so there are many characterizations of G2. Again, important for us is that G2 is the smallest, I should say, simple connected Lie group with a trivial center. Okay? So SO3 has a trivial center, as you know, but it's not simply connected. That's important for the simulations. So if you're interested in theories with a simple center, this is the smallest one, which you can take. Now, what is also very important later on for dynamical fermions, that you can choose all representations to be real. Not only pseudo-real as for SU2, but real. Now, the fundamental representation, the rank is 2, so there are two fundamental representations. These are the 7 and the 14. So the 14 at the same time is a adjoint representation. So in this group, the adjoint representation is one of the two fundamental representations. So instead of 3 and 3 bar, in SU3 you have a 7 and a 14. So that means if you put the quarks into this representation, you have 7 quarks instead of 3. Okay. So it's very similar like the SU5 or SO10 unification, the GATS unification, which we were interested in more than 20 years ago. I already mentioned, I should say more specific, if you put the Higgs field in the 7 representation, then you can break, or you break actually, G2 typically. You break into SU3. Okay, that's a way to break G2 to connect it to SU3. So the first thing you do always when you start to study a new theory, gauge theory, you look a little bit in the group theory to see what type of color singlets you may build up and what. So for example, you take the 777, which is 3 quarks, it's the same as in QCD, and you get a singlet, the color singlet out of it. So color now means G2 color. You have 2 gluons, 3 gluons, and they also can build a singlet. That's not much difference to QCD. But 7 times 7 also gives a singlet. That's a little bit different. In QCD, it's 3 bar times 3. And this is also different to QCD. So 3 gluons can screen 1 quark. This is really a new stage which you don't have in QCD. The reason is, of course, that the center is trivial. So there's no triviality. So if you break G2 to SU3, then what happens with the fermions, if you put the fermions into 7, the quarks, they go into 3 plus 3 bar, which is nice, but you get an additional singlet. So similar to SO10 breaking down to the standard model. And the gauge bosons, they go into the gluons of SU3 plus super heavy gauge bosons. So this is would be the breaking pattern from a kinematical point of view. So what do we know about G2 gauge theory, and why we are interested in studying this gauge theory? So we know that this theory is, of course, not astonishing. It's asymptotically free at very high temperatures, at very high energies. So we expect that we find a quark-gluon plasma at very high temperatures. We also know that the theory is confining at low temperature, at low energy. So in many respects, it behaves very similar to QCD. I mean, we have many observables which you calculated behave very similar qualitatively as in QCD. So we expect the phase transition. I come back to that. So I already mentioned there's a trivial center, and that was actually our original motivation some years ago to study this theory. You may remember 3, 4, 5 years ago, there were many models using very heavily the center to build models of confinement. Just think about center vortices. Some of the monopole-inspired models, they were very much dependent on the existence of the center. So the question was originally, is there a phase transition, a confinement phase transition in G2 gauge theory without center? So there is no simple order parameter, without dynamical fermions. Okay, so we can spontaneously break G2 to SU3. I mentioned that several times. I come back to it. People have studied two-color QCD, various groups, also people here in the room, which is, for many aspects, not as good as G2 for several reasons. One is in SU2, you don't have fermionic baryons, for obvious reasons, for group theoretical reasons. So you never can build a neutron stars on your computer. And for example, this is the most important point. So we have colorless fermionic baryons. And what is then also very important, that's the reality of the representation. There is no sign problem for any number of flavor, even for one flavor. OK? Okay, so IC2, you need an even number of flavor to get rid of the sign problem. For G2, there is no sign problem at all. The determinant is always positive. You can prove that. So we could, in principle, simulate a model at finite density and finite temperature, and that's what we do. So we could study what are the relevant degrees of freedom in a certain parameter region, phase transition, condensates, and transition between different phases, for example, at very high densities. That's what we are doing. And it's, of course, not QCD, but if ever we come to this parameter domain in SU3, we expect, of course, from a qualitative point of view, that the pictures will look very similar to the one I will show you. Okay. So, what is known? So, it's known that the theory shows a first order of confinement, a confinement phase transition. This already has been made clear in a beautiful paper of the Bern group. This really initiated this research. Hollands, Minkowski, Pepe, and Wiese. And this paper as well, they already convincingly demonstrated this is a first order confinement, deconfinement phase transition without order parameter, without breaking of the center symmetry. Now, later on, and we'll talk a little bit about this later on, it has been shown that this was our expectation that the theory shows Casimir scaling of the string tension. And even more, there are predictions for the string tensions, at least in three dimensions, by this beautiful work of Nair on Hamiltonian formulation of gauge theories. And we could check our string tension in the lowest representation with Nair's result, and they agree within some percent. So he was, of course, very happy, because he had, of course, to make some approximations. Okay, so we studied the effective Polyakov loop dynamics some years ago. It has been shown that the chiral restoration in the quench theory happens at the same temperature as the confinement-deconfinement phase transition. This is not obvious. If you take a thermoinitial joint representation there, the critical temperatures are off by a factor of 3. Also the same what we expect in QCD. So there is string breaking, again, because there is no center, somehow similar to QCD with dynamical matter. We looked at the glue lump spectrum and compared it with the string breaking scale. I will show it to you. Then I told you that we can solve spontaneously break it. Okay, just I learned here that if you take deform supersymmetric theory where the mass is switched on, so to say, then you can show that there's a confinement to confinement phase transition for small circumferences of S1 and small mass. Very recently, there has been a paper by the Italian group here, Bruno Cassell and so on the equation of state that's without fermions, pure gauge theory. And they studied the trace anomaly and the equation of state, again, qualitatively similar as QCD. Now, ongoing, and I will report on it, is a simulation of G2 with dynamical fermions at finite density and finite temperature. Yeah?
If a quark can be screened by gluons, yeah, what does strings and confinement mean?
I can't do that.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so let me come first discuss maybe something like 10 minutes or pure gauge theory without any fermions. So what you see here is the fundamental domain of the sort of Polyakov loop for G2. Now for SU3, to characterize the Polyakov loop, the gauge invariant content of the Polyakov loop, we take the trace of P and the trace of P bar, right? The trace of P in the two fundamental representations. This has a whole information about the Polyakov loop, the gauge invariant one. It's enough to know trace P, because you always just a complex conjugate in this case. Now for G2, what you take is the trace of the Polyakov loop in the one fundamental representation and the trace of the Polyakov loop in the other fundamental representation. This is a much better parameterization than the angles which you may use, because there you have lots of identification for G2. It's actually when I did this simulation, I did this calculation here, I calculated this boundary of the fundamental domain some years ago. I thought they never will hit. It's amazingly. I mean, that's really how it looks like. So of course you could imagine that the Polyakov loop never will come to this place, because there's just no entropy in this corner here. So typically it will fluctuate around here. And you also see that zero would mean Polyakov loop expectation value to be zero in both fundamental representations, would mean, restoration of, the P could be an order parameter. So zero is not a particular point in this fundamental domain. Okay, now you could do strong coupling expansion or mean field, and you could build up effective models for the Polyakov group. All this has been done and has been studied to get study the approximate phase plot tree and compare it with Monte Carlo simulation. I'm not talking about this one. This would take too much time. Just mention that this has been done in the past.
Why do you say it's an approximate order?
Sorry?
Why is it approximate order?
Well, there is no symmetry which you
but,
break.
But it is, it's still not a parameter.
No, it's not.
Well, look, there is many phase transitions in nature. Yeah. There is no symmetry breaking, but there is a discontinuous.
Yeah, like the density if you go from water to gas,
exactly.
For example.
It's a phase transition.
It's a phase transition,
yeah.
But we would say it's a phase transition without order parameter,
yeah,
because we relate order parameter to symmetries. In this sense, there is no order parameter.
Yeah, it's a kind of a terminology. People like it when it's zero in one phase and non-zero in the other.
You're right.
I like to call that an order parameter, but when it jumps from something non-zero to something other non-zero. Yeah. They don't call it an order parameter. Okay.
No, but it's more in one case you have a symmetry which
is
broken,
no
in the other not.
Yeah.
So there's
a clear
distinction.
Sorry.
Okay. So I don't have to say too much about, let me a little bit discuss now the static quark anti-quark potential, which you parameterize typically with a string tension, with this Lüscher term deduced from conformal field theory, and some offset. Okay. Now we. That's one of the first things we did. We took, you know, two charges in a given representation and calculated the static potential. And this goes, of course, into your question. And we wanted to see if there a linear rising potential. And if it's rising, how does the string tension depends on the representation? Because there has been some conjecture, which, you know, because it's true in two dimensions, there's a model which predicted that there's Casimir scaling, which tells us what is the ratio between two string tensions. And then at the end, we want to see, does the string breaks, where does it break, and does the scale where it breaks coincide with our expectations? Okay, so the first thing you realize for this group, and not only for this group, if you follow this one for long distances, of course, you have to, you know, to calculate quantities which differ by 50 or even in our case 60 orders of magnitude. And the only way to do it is really you can try smearing, but it's not good enough. You use the exponential error reduction. There's a beautiful algorithm developed by Martin Lüscher and Peter Weiss. That's what we used. We had to modify it a little bit to really very accurately follow this potential up to 50 orders of magnitude, because here's the exponent and the beta is, you know, it's not that small. Okay, so the conjecture is that the ratio of two string tension is just the ratio of the corresponding Casimir in the quadratic representation. This we got from ratio of Wilson loop, nothing special here, Kreutz ratios and so on. So these are the results. So we did the static potential for the heavy quarks in the eight smallest representations, and these are the dimensions of the eight smallest representation. So we went up to dimension 189, okay? And then what you show here, what you see here is the potential for the 7 representation, for the 14 representation, and up to the dimension 189 representation. And first of all, you see a linear rising potential. And then, of course, we know that at one point, the string must break, like in QCD with dynamical fermions or in the adjoint representation. Okay, now, but before I come to that, then what you do, you calculate the string tension and normalize it by the string tension in the 7 representation, and you plot it. And the lines which I show you are the theoretical prediction by the Casimir scaling, and the dots are the measured values, including error bars. It's amazing. It's one of the most beautiful pictures. There's one which may be a bit better on SU2, which is much easier to simulate, of course. The nicest picture you probably have ever seen of Casimir scaling, and that we have for G2. It's even better than SU3. I mean.
So the argument for Casimir scaling here is what? Is based on a Lattice strong coupling expansion? Or?
So there are several. There are models by people like Greenside, for example, where maybe you trust or not. It shows some scaling, then in two-dimensional gauge theory it's exact, you can just calculate it. So it's really model prediction and two-dimensional calculation as far as I know.
Right. It's not going to be expansion also.
Yes, that's obviously.
Okay.
Yeah. You also have some Casimir behaving in the Coulomb tail, of course, by perturbation theory, but I'm not talking about this one. So, and just to, you know, we analyze it and you find that the deviation is less than 4% in all these representations in three dimensions and less than 5% in the, there in four dimensions, we only went up to the representation, the lowest four representations. So there is no, yeah?
The last two seem to be out of order. 182 is gray and is leftmost.
This one, yeah, but you see already that the error bars, because here the signal is so small, right? And that, I mean, you have to look into your data and see up to which point you trust. Of course, there may be some bias there, you're right, but.
So do you have an understanding of the numbers, the constant on the right?
Yeah, yeah. They are just the Casimir of the quadratic representation.
Ah, so, I mean,
so these numbers are predicted, these lines.
So let's see, for 27, it's a non-integer, it's a 2 points.
I don't know by heart, a factor 3.6 or so, I don't remember.
They are not integers?
Sorry? Yeah.
They are not integers?
No. It's a ratio. It's a ratio of the Casimir, you know. Uh-huh. And even the Casimir of the 7 representation is not 1, of course.
You have some are integers.
It's rational numbers.
So you have 1, 2, 4, 5.
2.3.
But,
3.4.
Except for these two. But,
no.
So you have 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6 are integer.
Yeah. It's rational numbers and.
And so on.
Okay, now we follow the potential in the lowest two representations, the 7 and the 4th representation. And what we also did at the same time, of course, you know, from Gucci, you can estimate, you can look at what are the decay products. So in QCD, it would be 2 pions. Here it would be, in the 7 representation, it would be a quark shielded by 7 gluons. In the 14 representation, it would be 1 quark. In the 14, 1 static quark. In the 14 representation, screened by 1 gluon. So you take these operators and just calculate the corresponding masses of what you call gluons, consisting of quarks and a cloud of gluons. That's how it extracts this mass. And what we have shown here is the mass including error bars. And here it's actually very accurate. The error bars are extremely small. And then what you see here is this, the linear rising potential. And exactly at the point where we expect to break the string, it flattens the potential. So here, you know, the string breaks and decays into these gluons. And here I think it's very convincing. So that's very accurate. So what we expect that exactly happens, also it's the scale where we expected it to happen, and the decay products are those which we also knew in advance, essentially. Now here there's a little bit, it didn't bend around, and going into the data, it's just, you know, close enough to the continuum limit, that was the conclusion. Okay. So let me come now to, should not, let me shortly come to the G2 Higgs model. So we add now scalar field in the 7 representation. And what we assume, so this is the Higgs path, so we assume that the phi is in the 7 sphere, so it has length 1. That's the reason why there is no potential here. So it's sort of a nonlinear sigma model on the 7 sphere, which we couple to the gauge sector. So then you go to the pattern of symmetry breaking, and I just told you essentially already that G2 then breaks to SU3. So what I told you before, the 14 gauge bosons go into the gluons plus super heavy gauge particles. And the scalars go from 7 to 1. That's the usual breaking mechanism. So now what happens, let's a little bit look at what we expect for various values of the parameters. So if kappa is getting very large, of course, then we get a pure G2 gauge theory. We are back in the previous theory without scalar fields. So there we know that there's a first order deconfinement phase transition that I mentioned that is known for G2. And if kappa goes to infinity, or if you want, kappa is of course related to the vacuum expectation of the Higgs field, if this is becoming very large, then the six vector bosons decouple, the heavy vector bosons, and we get a pure asymmetric gauge theory. So by, well, it's well known, by varying kappa, the Hopping parameter, you interpolate, so to say, between G2 and SU3 gauge theories. Okay, and of course, also for kappa equals infinity, we are in pure QCD without fermions, we have a first order deconfinement transition. So the question is there a first order transition light which connects these two points, right? So we have this parameter space, and plotted here again. So here, Hopping parameter, Hopping parameter zero, we have G2 gauge theory. Hopping parameter infinity, we have SU3 dual dynamics. There's a first order phase transition here. There's a first order phase transition here. Now, if beta goes to infinity or G goes to zero, then we just have the sigma model, and we know this breaks from 0.7 to 0.6. So we have a second order phase transition here. So we are sure about this region, this region, this region. And this was the suggested phase diagram already actually by the Byrne group again. So the question is what happens here in between? Okay. So is the confinement phase related to the deconfinement phase? Does the first order line go through all the way? And so on. So we made some sort of parameter study. And measured certain observables. I will come to that. And because this is no fermions, we have a very good statistic. We can look at histograms to see whether it's first order, second order. Of course, you look at susceptibilities, you know, all the things we look at. And there's nothing very exciting here. But of course, it's very expensive because we take a grid in beta and kappa space, and we have to do lots of simulations. So just some technical videos, a local hybrid Monte Carlo based on this Coset representation. We started the Higgs transition line. This theory has a bulk transition, monopole transition. We had to be careful not to interfere with this bulk transition. So we calculate the average Planck detection, the Higgs action, the Polyakov loop, the susceptibilities, and even higher derivative of the partition function. And what we found is there is this line of second order which goes almost hits the first order line. And the first order line almost goes through. So what I mean by that, I tell you in a minute. And the two lines, that was our first conclusion, meet at this value of beta and kappa. This picture. So each of these points means that we did the simulations. You know, we went here to the parameter space, that's actually by 90 degrees, and looked at histograms and susceptibilities to see what type of phase transition we have. And then here's the place where the two lines meet, and this is the bulk transition here, this dotted line here. It is close to the first order line. So we had to adjust NT in a way not to see this. Not to be disturbed by this bulk transition.
Sorry, I missed. What is the difference between the bulk and the first order transition?
So the bulk is an artificial transition and used by these lattice monopoles. Okay. And you see the difference by looking at the scaling. But one changes when you change NT and the other does not. Okay. That's how you can easily distinguish it.
Okay. So what is the finite temperature?
Yes.
What was the temperature? Do you see the finite temperature moving with the temperature?
I think later on I have even UV scales when I come later on. Then we will see. Here this was just in bare units at the moment. So you see here we had to look more closer in. So this insert I show you next, because we didn't know whether it really meets there. So this little insert, very small parameter space, again, this type of studies. And so what we came up is with this first order line here going through. So look at this parameter. So it's a very small parameter domain. First line, and the second line hitting this first order line. But then he looked even further into this region here, because, you know, it's very, very difficult, of course, to distinguish a second order or weakly first order phase transition from a crossover. I mean, the lattice world is not arbitrary, it's large in our simulations. So we look more into the histograms here. My experience after doing these many, many studies is histogram is really a very good way to look into phase diagram. It contains all the information which you have in the higher moments. Okay. So finally, we're looking carefully into data, but we're not absolutely sure. It seems there's a window in this first order line. Okay, so there's a crossover from the confinement to the deconfinement phase. And of course, there are theorems which tell you sometimes there must be such a window. Friedan, Schenker, whatever, Osterweiler-Seiler theorem, we have checked that it does not apply. So it could be closed, it could be open. From a theoretical point of view, we don't know. But it looks, but we are not absolutely sure, I should say, because it's very, very tricky. It's this very small parameter domain. There may be a crossover between the two.
This is not universal. You need to take the continuum limit on top of that.
In addition, yes, yes.
So
what is the continuum limit? Well, to be honest, we check two lattice sizes. And, you know, really to do an honest continuum limit.
Is it called continuum limit infinite for you?
No, it's a real question.
So later on, I don't want to say always later on, but later on we really kept the physics constant. I will show you in a second.
I just realized I don't understand that in my mind, what you limit is a limit where I tune the parameters to a second order of this transition.
No, this is just a lattice studies, right? At the moment, and it's a finite lattice without worrying about any continuum limit. Now you could think about where could I construct a continuum limit of the field theory, first of all, or second, where this is our interpretation, this is a finite temperature phase transition, this would be a real first order phase transition.
Let me add one thing, if this is really continuum physics, as you increase in t and you look at this curve, the point at which this transition hits, for instance, the x-axis, would move to beta infinity. So it is the same. I mean, it corresponds to going at beta infinity, so at the fixed point.
So what you are saying is that, there is a fixed point, an ultraviolet fixed point at beta infinity.
Yeah,
I understand that, but I am not certain that that's where
we
want to define it.
Is it? I think so. It doesn't put it differently. It's really like SU3 in this respect. Really. You would increase n, you would decrease a, you would increase beta, and that would be how you would come to the continuum limit usually. But that's not what you have done here. This should usually this, but it's a finite temperature phase transition here. Okay.
Okay. So it's a finite temperature phase transition.
Because it's an asymmetric lattice, I didn't really tell you. The lattice is asymmetric. The change in beta, you may think, is changing the temperature.
So it's an asymmetric, and I should think about the solid line as a finite temperature.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And it will move to beta infinity as n goes to infinity, assuming that the spatial volume
is big enough. Yeah.
Okay. What happens to the top one?
So this one, this is the final temperature phase transition of SU3.
That's SU3, so that the old.
That's the old phase transition of SU3, final temperature.
Okay.
So now let me come to the most important part, inclusion of dynamical fermions. So the determinant for any mass, for any chemical potential is positive. So as I said, we can do simulation at finite temperature and finite mu. So we could try to study the different phases, in particular the phase transitions at high densities. And what we looked at is the chiral condensate, the baryon density as a function of temperature and chemical potential, the Polyakov loop, which is especially useful for low baryon density, and you could think about different condensates, and in particular the diquark condensate, which I have no data yet, but that's what we are doing, because in these theories the diquark condensate can be rotated into the chiral symmetry, into the chiral condensate. So the question, and then if you see phases and phase transition, finite temperature or finite density phases and phase transitions, of course, to interpret these phase transitions, you have to know the particle spectrum. Because you may believe there's an there may be a Bose-Einstein condensate of something. So you have to know what is the something, what is the scale of the something. Okay, so the first thing what we did is to look at the spectroscopy. So we calculated the zero temperature, the glue ball masses, mesomasses, baryon masses. And before I go on, I should tell you what this is for, but the one flavor model. The symmetry pattern. So there's actually a U2, which is broken by the anomaly for SU2. So this is one flavor. So this theory has an enlarged chiral symmetry. I don't know if maybe under the name Pauli-Gerze symmetry.
What do you call one flavor? A Dirac fermion in the 7?
It's a Dirac fermion in the 7. Yeah. So it has an SU2 symmetry in the massless case and without chemical potential. If you switch on a mass or if you have a chiral condensate, this breaks down to U1, which we identify with a baryon number. If you include a chemical potential, the same happens, so it stays. If you have several flavors, it's a bit more complicated. The best way to do it is you go to the Majorana representation, because it's a real group, this is really the adapted representation. And then you easily see what the symmetric groups are. It's actually something like orthogonal groups, special orthogonal groups, and so on, which then break down. But let me talk about the most simple case here. So there's an enlarged chiral symmetry, which you break either by chiral condensate or by a finite density. Okay, now, if you break this SE2, for example, by the chiral condensate, if you break this by chiral condensate, then we have Goldstone bosons, and there are two of those, and this will be diquarks. So there are two diquarks, this parity of class conjugation. So these two, interpolating operators would then belong to these Goldstone bosons in the one flavor case. And there's a massive case by the corresponding particle, which we call F, corresponding to QCD. So we used Wilson fermions, some improved gauge action, the rational Hilbert Monte Carlo algorithm. And these are the fixed parameters. Actually, we had two ensembles. These are very expensive calculations. So we did some parameter study to find the optimal parameters for our resources. And this is what we chose. So the lattice are very small. And we very, so this was for the spectroscopy, I should say. We fix the Kale with the nucleon mass. And the diquark mass, which is the diquark is a Goldstone boson, as I mentioned. This is not as light as, of course, we would like it to be. It's 250 MeV. And it's a sort of a coarse lattice. But you will see in a moment why, at the moment, we stick to this rubber coarse lattices.
How are you determining the lattice spacing?
Sorry?
How are you determining the lattice spacing?
The scale setting is done by the...
Sorry?
You took the nucleon mass to be what it is. Yeah. So in the other case, we had the string tension, but here we took the nucleon mass, and was very accurately could be determined. So we did finite temperature and density studies, and we took lattice sizes with varying NT to change the temperature from 2 to 16, which belong in this unit of temperatures between 36 and 287 MeV. And for each temperature, we took 60 different values of the chemical potential and then measured the observables. Okay, so we really scanned to the UT phase diagram. I should say, early on, we did the simulation at T equals 0. with much better statistic, with bigger lattices and so on. But these new results will really go to all the phase space. We had to go to small lattices. You know, the statistic is typically 300-400 configurations. You cannot do more. I mean, you have a reasonably good computer resources, but this is not so easy. Okay. So just a little bit the spectrum of the theory. So wherever we have the same quantum numbers as in QCD, we use the same names. Okay, so we have something like it. So these are the mesons with baryon number 0, the eta, F particle, omega, H particles with the corresponding quantum numbers, and the interpolating operators here. And then if we take partially quenched one-flavor simulations where we allow for two-flavor interpolating operators but do the simulations with one flavor, that we do from time to time, then you have these additional particles here, like the pion in particular. So these are the mesons, or the lowest lying meson probably. Then we have interpolating particle with baryon number 1, but this is the quark baryon number, so this would be in QCD 1/3. Right? So we have the hybrid, which is we cannot simulate at the moment, it's just too noisy. And you can imagine, I mean, it's one quark and you have three gluons here. You know, that's a single set which I meant at the beginning. Then we have something like a delta tilde, we called, and the tilde, the nucleon tilde, they all have such the baryon number of one quark. This is something we don't have in QCD, the additional states. Then we have diquarks. These are the two Goldstone bosons, and of course you have others, especially here if you have the two-flavor model, you have these additional diquarks here. But in the one-flavor simulation, these are the two Goldstone bosons. Then you have particles with baryon number 3 or 1 in conventional language, which is a nucleon, is same operators in QCD, and the delta. And I always wrote the group theory beyond it. I mean, this 777, like a QCD, gives you a signal. So the d-quarks actually were nice because, like the pions, they have no disconnected contributions. For those who know a little bit about the SU2 simulations, for example, of the group in Southampton, they had to introduce sources for the diquarks, which was very important to get reasonable numbers for the baryon number density. They had to introduce a diquark source, and did the simulation diquark source going to zero because of accumulation of small eigenvalues of the Dirac operator. To get rid of this problem in the hybrid Monte Carlo simulations, they had to introduce these sources. And this was lots of headache. I mean, it's, now here, we don't have this problem. We checked this, sometimes the small eigenvalues. We didn't need any diquark sources, so there's no extrapolation needed. I mean, we have done it for the Majorana fermions later on, but for the Dirac fermion, it's not necessary. Okay. So this is a spectrum which we got something a year or 1.5 years ago. So here you see the Goldstone bosons. They are not really degenerate, because we are not really simulating at zero temperature. And here you have something like the deltas and the nucleons. They will be important in the identification of the phase transition later on. But this is a nucleon scale, if you want. Again, we set it to this 938 MeV. And here this is the other scale by 250 MeV of the Goldstone bosons, the diquark. And then some excited states. So these are the error bars, by the way, of course.
What is the volume here?
So again, it was a very small volume. This was 16 to the power of 4, if I remember correctly. 16 cubed times nt. I mean, this was in four-dimensional simulation. And then t was 16 or 32 even. Okay, so again, this is has been shown in the lattice a year ago. So what this is the result of a half-year calculation, so to say, of the baryon number density as a function of the chemical potential at very low temperature. Actually, it was something like 37 MeV in our scale setting. So what you see is again at the baryon number density I told you, and what you could see is here a little shoulder here is going up, and it's almost zero below in agreement with the silver place prediction. And then here you see again a plateau of the density. That the scale given by this second DO minus, you get a little plateau again, and then it goes up. Okay. So what we interpret this part is this seems to be not much disputed, that here we get the Bose-Einstein condensation of these dipoles. So these two dipoles bind to a, you know, to a boson with baryon number because it's a dipole. So there, here we have a condensation of these dipoles. And here at this threshold of the DO minus, again, this is not so certain. There may be a second condensate building up of this DO minus particles and then gathers up. And here we come to the nuclear scale, and then the baryon density goes up. And here we believe, I come back to that, that there is probably a first order phase transition. And these two may be, but it's not certain, second order phase transitions. Okay. This is rather new result, and I think this is very exciting. I mean, in QCD, if we come to this point, we will have, in the first one, we have similar pictures, I'm sure. The question is to interpret this phase transition. What exactly does it mean?
You can measure the condensate to validate your interpretation.
We are just taking data now for the dipole condensate at the moment. The chiral condensate we looked at. We'll come to that. But we would prefer to have the dipole now condensate. And actually, this is an interesting question. Is there an independent check on the lattice to see whether there is a condensate, a Bose-Einstein condensate? I believe one has to go a little bit away from the equilibrium to check that, but it would be welcome, any idea to check an independent check, not going just via the condensate, to see what is the character of a certain condensate. I mean, if you have a conjecture, how to check it?
And usually, at least in the SU2 case, when you have a dipole condensate, then it's associated with matchless modes and with the small eigenvalues of the Dirac operator. That's why the people in Swansea put a source there.
So with the massless, load I showed you, right? Remember, this was the, this is the Goldstone boson here. This is the mass of the Goldstone boson. Okay. Normalized by the quark number, I should say. And you see that at this scale, it's not exactly this scale, but this may be finite temperature effects, it goes up. Okay, so the identification seems to be clear. It's a condensation very probably of these Goldstone bosons, which are baryons in this case. Okay. And the same here, this is the mass of this particle, this diquark, this baryon. And it's very tempting to believe that this is the second condensation of this diquarks. Well, it's not so clear whether here this is a first order phase transition. You cannot see from this plot at all. But this is the conclusion which I now want to go into more. That at low temperature, we expect at least 2 second order phase transition and a first order phase transition to nucleonic matter at roughly 300 MeV. So again, I summarized here what we took from this and similar simulations. In low density, let me repeat, we see the silver blaze property that the baryon density is essentially zero. It doesn't change at all. We have two small, I shouldn't call it chunks, changes of the baryon density at the dipole thresholds, and we interpret this at the moment as two probably second order phase transitions. We have two plateaus after the thresholds, which we interpret as a Bose, different Bose condensates of diquarks. There's very probably now a first order phase transition at the nucleon or delta threshold from quark gluonic plasma to nuclear matter. Now, the hadronic phase for higher NQ is under investigation. I hope that I could show it at the beginning. Unfortunately, not. Now, of course, at a certain density, this unit A mu bigger than 1, you see the lattice artifacts. You get all saturation effects which you expect, and which people with Langevin have first reproduced for the Polyakov loop, for example. But so all the pictures I show you are far below this, where you see the lattice artifacts.
Why did you put the question on the Bose-Kron as a type first?
Well, that's what I said before. I mean, you really must be very sure in the identification. I mean, the threshold identification tells us it should be Bose Einstein condensate. But I would like to make more measurements. Maybe independent of
that. There should be a phonon or something like that, which is what you were asking, right?
You should?
There should be a phonon associated with that.
Yeah.
Is there a way to see that? Or?
Well, you mean a Goldstone boson, right?
Yes, right.
Yes, I showed you. I mean, the D is the Goldstone boson, that we know. And the mass of the D of the Goldstone
boson? No. There should be there's a Bose-Kron also.
Yeah,
it's of T's. Invariant number.
Yes,
so
of T's.
There should be a Goldstone boson associated with that. With the fluctuation of the Kron.
In addition, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Looking at the spectrum of the Dirac operator, for example, is in this case, we discussed it, is a nightmare. I mean, but okay, we should maybe talk about it. Okay, so this is now first again chemical potential zero. So on the left, final temperature to see what we have there. So here is the Polyakov loop. Now here we use the scale setting of the nucleon. The Polyakov loop is derivative, and from this maximum, we estimate something like it's not really a phase transition as we know, like in QCD. Anyway, we call it the critical temperature. In this case, it's 137 MeV. And we were a little bit worried about these little shoulders here, which we have seen in all our simulations. So we checked it, actually, shame on me, it was thermalization effects, which made this problem here. So the first shoulder is always physical. And we were a little bit, wondering what is happening here. Okay, so this is how the Polyakov looks like. So you would say there's probably a crossover at one rough 140 MeV. Okay, this is a chiral condensate, how it deviates from the Stefan-Boltzmann lattice chiral condensate. Remember, we use Wilson fermions. It looks not very enlightening, and if you're analyzing this plot, we really couldn't say for sure that the critical temperatures are the same for the chiral condensate and the Polyakov loop, which is much better in this sense.
How could you even decide? Huh? How could you even decide the answer to this question?
No, I didn't give any number.
Still transitions. So.
Still not clear whether confinement and chiral transition temperature, if you can define it at all.
Right.
Okay, so now, the plots I showed you just now was here, right? And we got this would-be phase transition here, this crossover here at this point at 137 MeV. I showed you also this baryon density, which was taken here on this line. Yeah, where you have seen the shoulders of this phase transition. Of course, the question is now, what happens to this point when you increase the density? So to answer this question, or try to answer this question, we did a similar thing as we did for the Higgs model. We did a parameter study. So and this is really what we did along these arrows. At this temperature, this was, 287 MeV. We took data at 60 different values of mu. Okay. And then repeated them for this chemical potential down to very low temperatures. So what we were interested is, well, where is the transition? Let me use the word transition. Where is the transition line moving in this phase diagram? Could you say something whether the transition, let's guess, stronger? Of course, the dream would be to see some critical endpoint of a line which may emerge actually somewhere here. Okay. Now, I will show you, unfortunately we didn't come far enough. We went up to 350 MeV in the chemical potential, and the curve is flatter than I plotted it here. It looks something like this one. We certainly have to go with simulation to higher mu to address this question. And these are the data which I was expecting these days. Unfortunately, I didn't get it. And we do the simulation up to 540 MeV. And then I think we will have a good picture about it will be very hard to identify an endpoint or region where we expect this endpoint. But at least in this region, we have some very nice results. So let me go a little bit through. So just these are typical data which we take. Again, the Polyakov loop and its this corresponding susceptibility as a function of the temperature at different chemical potentials. Chemical potential zero, baryon density zero, and you increase the baryon density. So these are just three of these lines, if you want. So what you see, the Polyakov loop, if you increase the temperature, if you move the density, move to the left. And at the same time, the would-be critical temperature goes down. Okay, again, this is this thermalization problem here, the shoulder. So that's what they expect. If you increase the temperature, that the critical mu comes down. If you increase mu, that the critical temperature comes down. That's another way to say it. Okay. So this is sort of summarizes the result for the Polyakov loop. So we took all these data, which I told you, along these lines, and did the analysis along the lines. Okay, and this is sort of a color plot of the value of the Polyakov loop. And this is maybe more interesting, is the color coding of the susceptibility. Okay, and of course, you do cubic splines to draw these curves and identify the critical temperature. This is this 137, which I showed you before, and that is how the transition line goes down. So that is where the maximum, it's the maximum of the susceptibilities of this line. Of course, you have to analyze it more carefully, but this figure very nicely shows how this transition line looks like. Okay, and it's somehow like expected. And then you could fit it to a polynomial. This is in this domain between 0 and 300 MeV, the fit of the critical temperature as a function of the chemical potential. Well, divided by the normalized to 1, from here it was 0. Now, what you see here is certainly this data is consistent with this coefficient to be 0. So it's a parabola with slope 0. This is completely consistent with the data, and that's how it behaves like. It would be, of course, interesting now to compare that with what you do in QCD, right, for small mu. But, where in QCD we are stuck to this region, we have now this simulation up to 300 MeV. Okay?
You have an explanation? The linear term is U, some kind of symmetric reason?
I should say I got the data not long ago. I should now think about it here. Well, maybe
the free energy is even in you.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. Simple. Yeah. Sure. I would have to think about it in G2 because particle antiparticle is.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll probably that's it. Thank you. So you prove that our data are correct, right? this is some typical picture. Maybe there are lots of these graphs depending on the temperature. You start with the highest temperature, and again, as I showed you previously, you increase mu, and you measure something like the quark number density. Then you decrease the temperature and see how the curves change. So what you see here is the quark density measured for these different values of mu, compared to the Stefan Boltzmann prediction for Wilson fermions on the same lattice, of course. And what you see here is the ratio of the two. So at this temperature, far above the critical temperature, it behaves like a free gas of quarks. That's what you see here. And then you go down, you know, then the deviation from the Stefan-Boltzmann law increases. But you don't see any threshold, of course, at these high temperatures. Further decrease the temperature, 150. And remember, 150 is not very far from the critical temperature, which is 130-something. This is a little bit below the critical temperature. So you expect that you should see something now. So you go further down in the temperature. Okay, and then you see slowly, but I should say, I mean, this the barrier number here is very small. It's 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 4. And then you get the problem with the statistics. I mean, of course, you use estimator to calculate these correlation functions. And we used typically 10 estimators, so probably that was not enough to get a reasonable good statistic here. So this may be really a question of the simulation. Okay. And you see it also here. I mean, the errors become very large for small chemical potential. And then you go down, and slowly you see how this condensates sort of develop. Okay, this is still a higher temperature than the one I showed you, and it's far off Stefan-Boltzmann gas. And this is then the low temperature. We didn't come below 36 with our geometry. And then again, this is a different calculation than the previous one, but you can identify the sort of phases here. Okay.
So you guessed that there are two thresholds for your diquark condensation. But didn't you say at the beginning that you could also screen a single quark with three gluons?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that
yes.
a lower threshold yet?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Is hybrids, that's what you have in mind. In principle, yes. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to analyze the hybrids. That's in the back of our head, but we gave up on it. We tried. The noise is just...
If you just measure the density, you should see some additional feature which does not match your diquark threshold.
Yeah. So far, we haven't seen any feature which... But somehow, at least the diquark with three field strings and one quark probably is heavier, you know, from our experience with QCD. You think about the global mass and the and QCD. So this is our working hypothesis that they don't interfere. But you're right. I mean, they could be produced. Yeah. Okay. What did I do? I finished my talk. Okay, so this I wanted to show you. Now this is a scale where we expect that we have a first order phase transition from a quark gluon phase to a hadronic phase. This is low temperature again, and you increase the chemical potential. So we looked at the histogram of the quark number density at this low temperature. Now I should just look at this one. The bands are quite wide. I first should say, it looks like a phase transition. That's what we know from Monte Carlo simulation. You jump from one minimum to the other, and you can look for Monte Carlo times and the scaling of Monte Carlo times when it jumps from one minimum to the other. What is a little bit wide here is the bands, but that again is because we didn't take enough estimators. This is statistical noise, which is probably not in the system, but it's due to the not enough estimators which we took. But this looks, again, I told you we have lots of experience. This is now not a very objective statement, like a first order phase transition. And if we look a little bit carefully into the data, the phase transition seems to be at around 220 MeV for this geometry and this scale which we took. Okay, this really looks like a first order phase transition. Obviously, I mean it's a two phase region, very well separated. Here, and here you have the symmetric phase here. So from this type of histograms, you sort to believe that this is a first order phase transition from the phase to the hadronic phase. Okay, now you can repeat the same, for example, the Polyakov loop, which at least at high temperature and small mu is a nice observable. And again, what you look is the, actually the Polyakov loop and the chiral condensate. Maybe, you go down with the temperature and see how it behaves. And then you start, let's go a bit further. This is where we expect the transition, 130. This is the, a little bit below the phase transition point that things should happen here. Right? And if you look just with your eyes at the data, you see something is happening here. and go further down. And up to 36 degrees. Okay. Now, we analyzed, of course, this data we analyzed. This one is probably a real condensate, and this we shouldn't trust these numbers for the reason I gave you before. This is a conclusion. Okay, so let me just say two or three more sentences. We did other investigations, of course, including Majorana fermions, to worry about more dike quarks. But one thing which is very interesting, but we just started, is looking at the lattice correlation functions at finite density. Okay. Now, this is what we expect, how the the correlation function looks for interpolating operators Clark number and Q. So you have this typical offsets minus NQ mu and plus NQ. This quark number is not zero. And this is, for example, the simulation here for the dike quark. So this is essentially at almost zero baryon density. And then you increase the baryon density. And what you see in this is a shift of this curve due to this extra term. Okay. Now, below is this silver blaze point. We don't expect that this M depend on mu. Okay, so that this is a linear function, this exponent. And this we could check for the dike quarks. And the expectation is sort of fulfilled. What you see here is, at least the data for the red points shows some indication of a linear dependence, I would say. Okay. This would be the theoretical prediction from the curve I gave you before. And so these are, again, very recent data. I shouldn't make too much a point, but it goes in this direction, that there's a linear behavior. And we are far below the silver blaze problem with 50 MeV. So the silver blaze is roughly 120 MeV or some point. Okay. And this is for the pion in this partially quenched calculation. Okay, so let me sort of summarize the status. So again, here is the parameters-based view temperature. And this white region is the region which we scanned with our simulations. And this is the transition line which we got, starting at this 137. It's very flat. Okay. This, I hope, will be out in a week or two at latest, and then finally we should really make it public. So here we have the vacuum structure, the NQ is zero. Then we have a dike quark threshold, and a second dike quark threshold to second order phase transition, is to both the Einstein condensates, and very probably a first order phase transition. That's one of the last pictures I showed you, the nuclear matter at around 300 MeV in this scale. Okay, there are many, many, many questions, and the question is how far should you go with G2, right? I mean, it's not QCD after all. Well, of course, finite size effect. The lattice were not big enough, no question. But still, we think, we have, in case you was early on, made small lattice studies and then increased the lattice size, where it was very cheap, and so we sort of feel confident that some of the statements are really we should trust. But there's evidence for first order nuclear matter transition. There's chiral symmetry restoration. But really, to see that more clearly, you should make simulation with two flavors, where we have a pion like in QCD, not only the dike quarks. We see confinement phase transition at low temperature. The question is about the critical endpoints, and I think we have a chance to answer this question in this model soon. Difficult, you mentioned it, is a hybrid spectroscopy. We are not sure we are going to do that. Maybe just too expensive. We should continue our spectroscopy at finite density. be looking, but we are not finished looking at the Tycho condensation, and of course, equation of state. So I thought, or I hope, that I convinced you also G2 is not QSD, also it's exceptional. And also the original motivation was a different one than the results I showed you the last half hour, that G2 is a really useful laboratory for to answer some questions we certainly will have in QSD in the future. And many aspects, I didn't talk about, you know, instanton picture, dilute instanton, and certain correlation factors, they qualitatively look all the same like in QCD, I'll show you. So I showed you that we can interpolate between G2 and QCD with the Higgs mechanism. So of course it would be tempting to do the following. Take G2 with dynamical fermions, as we did, add a Higgs field, and break G2 down to SU3 slowly. Okay, we have no sign problem in G2.
But at some point it should reappear.
Right. That's, you take away what I want to say. Of course. You have no free lunch, somebody would say. It will come back at one point. But the question is, at which value of kappa, right, does it hit you? Okay? You may be lucky that you learn enough about QCD before you're completely ruined by the sign. You can sometimes live with a sign problem, right? The trajectories are long enough before you the sign flips or whatever.
One could
revise
the argument, say that until you
don't
really see a strong sign problem.
Exactly.
That's a pessimistic point of view.
Okay,
I took it from him. Okay. So the phase diagram of this theory is in principle accessible to simulation. I think this is clear. It would be interesting, and I already indicated it, that we really should try to start maybe from the first order line at low temperature, large mu, going backwards to smaller mu. That is maybe something to see, better strategy to find something like a critical endpoint. So it's also a testbed for model building, and it has been, by the way. For example, just at the moment, there are people doing this strong coupling, hopping parameter expansion, you know, which a Frankfurt group did, Uwe Philipsen and so on. They do it for, or they have done it most of G2. But they have to assume that the masses of the quarks are heavy. I mean, else it doesn't work, and the chemical potential is large. So not me, but some of my collaborators have done a simulation of G2 in this parameter domain and compared it with a strong coupling expansion. They fit nicely. I even have some figures here. Okay, it's of course I could think about checking some other expansions or maybe even randomization group, and there have been some very rudimentary FRG calculation for G2. Actually, people who were involved with each other also in Jena at that time. So it's, you know, even if you don't think about too much about QCD, it's just to check approximation method with dynamical fermions. At finite density and finite temperature, you can use this model to check these approximations. Okay, this is now really the end.
If it's a short answer. So at some point you said that when you were considering the G2 theory with the fundamental Higgs, you said that the Fradkin-Schenker argument did not apply, that the Higgs and confinement should be connected.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what's the difference between
SU and this. So just the usual SUN case, as you know, the fermion is a fundamental representation and joint, they make a big difference. But the real question is what the difference is at large kappa, okay? If there's a fundamental representation, you know there's no phase transition. So there's two ingredients. One is the exact breaking scale, whether it's fundamental or a joint, right? And the other is with kappa equals infinity, whether there is a symmetry breaking or not. And in this case, we have a symmetry breaking for SU3. This is the main difference, actually. So that's it. I mean, you know, the people say a fraction Schenker is just adjoint versus fundamental, but it's more. It's you have to look into the breaking mechanism, you know, whether there's a U1 left or not, and this kind of questions. Of course, we are hoping that we have such an argument that would help us a lot in saving time.
So as you turn on your chemical potential at say zero temperature, your interpretation is that you have both a condensation of one species of diquarks and then another one, and then eventually nuclear matter. But if that's true, then I would expect the quark density to jump one time when you have the first Bose condensation, then jump a second time, and by the time you reach the threshold for nuclear matter, the density will be rather high.
That's exactly what is happening.
So your vertical scale showed very small numbers. Yeah. Maybe I was confused.
What does it mean, small? But we really checked that these numbers are not zero. I mean,
but I would expect numbers of order the saturation density on your lattice. Don't have anything to do with continuum.
What you have seen is saturation density at very large mu. Mm-hmm. You have to go to much higher density to see saturation density. These are relatively small mu's, so it's not on saturation. Should I show you again that it's a bit more?
Seems to me you're violating the no free lunch theorem.
I wouldn't dare. Oh, this was too far. Yes.
Yeah. So what is the maximum value of NQ for G2?
Well, it depends, again, whether it's a quark baryon density or, in this case, it's something like 10 divided by 7 or 14 divided by 7 or something like that. So it goes really up to more than one.
14 times 7.
Divided by 7. The number of, I think that's what it was. I can check it, but it's of the order of 1 or 2, or maybe even 3. Don't care too much. And we did some simulation up to saturation. This was 1.3 or 4 these units, and it really goes up. But you don't trust the result anymore. Now, so there is an increase here, and it is there. Right? And there's one here, and exactly at the mass scale of the dibaryons which we believe to condensate. Okay. Then you have the rise here, and it steeply rises, exactly like I said.
Fantastic.
I completely agree. I mean, these are beautiful results. Sorry for that, for saying that. But yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to.
Five more minutes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, stop me at 11. Can you show 7 times 7?
So what you want to hear about, it's quite a one?
What is the symmetric and anti-symmetric?
I always do it wrong. I give you the whole list if you want.
Yeah. Okay, so so I think 27 and 1 are in the symmetric channel, and 7 and 14 are in the anti-symmetric, is that correct? So I looked in SO7.
Yeah.
So SO7 breaks into 28 symmetric and 21 anti-symmetric.
Yeah.
And then the 28 goes into 27 plus the trace. So these are the 27 plus the trace are symmetric, and
that's
7
true.
Plus
yes.
14 are anti-symmetric.
Yes. If you interpret in the SO7, I completely agree. Yes. That's one nice way to do it. But then you have to go to SO7 to G2, and then you take away the traces and these things. And that's right.
Thank you, Andreas, very much.